by making an announcement or two. Is the mic too loud? It's okay. I have office hours today, 1 to 2. If you want to talk to me personally about something, it's better to come right before or right after or toward the end, because usually we spend office hours mostly answering general questions that people have. People are welcome to come to office hours. It's in my it's around my office, 744 Mudd. And even if you don't have any questions, you're welcome to come and listen to the people who do. Now, I want to pick up what we were talking about last time. We were talking about last time about regulating gene expression, how you turn on a gene and get it to make protein. And what we emphasized last time was how you loosen up or tighten the chromatin. And today I want to consider mostly what happens after that, which is, given that you have opened up the chromatin now, what happens to the RNA that you make? We've talked before not only about opening the chromatin, but also about getting RNA polymerase started, that it has to have all those transcription factors to get ready. But then, once it goes, what then? So there are many ways to get at this, but one way to look at it is what I've written up there, which is first to ask the question, if you have two cell types that are making different proteins, what is responsible for the difference? And then, if you consider not different proteins, but a cell making the same protein, how can you get it to make more or less? So that's one or two ways of looking at regulation. So let's start with the first one. And last time, when we were talking about two cell types making different proteins, we picked a specific example. We said chicken red blood cells versus chicken oviduct. One makes globin, one makes ovalbumin. And today I want to use a human example, although I could use that one. The liver cells make many proteins, and one of the ones they make is transferrin, which we've already talked about. This is the protein that binds iron and carries it around through the bloodstream. Now, red blood cells don't have nuclei, but their precursors do. These are immature cells which still have nuclei, and as they specialize further, will jettison their nuclei and turn into red blood cells. And these cells make globin. So these cells, of course, they make other proteins, but these are two characteristic proteins made by these two characteristic cell types. And we want to ask, what is the difference between the two cell types? So the first question is, what about the DNA? So if we were to draw the DNA, well, clearly there's a globin gene here that's being used to make globin, and there's a transferrin gene here that's being used to make transferrin. So are the two DNAs the same? Yes. We say all the time the DNA in all of your cells is the same, with the exception of some of the cells of your immune system. And how and why they're different we'll get to at the end of the course. So the DNA is the same. So, of course, there's a globin gene here, although it's not working at the moment. And there's a transferrin gene here, although it's not working at the moment. So the DNA is the same. Is the message different? Well, the whole assumption is if they're making different proteins, they're making different messages. So we assume that in this one, we're making transferrin message, and in the other one, we're making globin message. Now, there is a significance to the fact, a practical one, that the mRNAs in the different cell types are different. Are they going to be totally different? Is there going to be any overlap between the message in this cell and the message in that cell? And the answer is yes, because both cells are making certain common so-called housekeeping proteins. And so both cells are made, cell types are making the messages sort of your basic run the operation proteins. But for the specialized proteins that let you do your liver thing or your blood thing, for those messages, the liver ones are unique to liver, and the globin ones, etc., are unique to the precursors to red blood cells. So the mRNAs made are not the same. They overlap, but they're not the same. Now, the significance of that is if you think back to genetic engineering, we talked about making libraries, which basically meant collections. You cut up this DNA, and you made a collection of pieces cloned in some vehicle. Well, if you cut up this DNA and make a library, or you cut up that DNA and make a library, how is the library different? It should be exactly the same. A DNA library is a DNA library. It's the same collection, whatever cell type you get it. Now, you can't clone message, but you can take these messages, and using reverse transcriptase, you can make the DNA version of the RNA. So you can make what's, and you can take those cDNAs and you can clone them in vehicles and you can make a cDNA library. Will the volume, so to speak, in the red blood cell precursor cDNA library be the same as the volumes in the liver cDNA library? And the answer here is no, because the sequences in the two libraries will overlap, but they will be different. Because each library of cDNA library reflects the genes that are being used in that cell, not the total gene collection. And the genes used in the two cells are different. So, what about the state of the chromatin? Within this area here, these genes actually I think are on different chromosomes, but for the sake of argument, I've drawn them near each other. Consider the state of the chromatin in this area. Is it the same in both cells? Do we know how to find out? The kind of experiment we talked about last time would enable you to find out. And in fact, what would you expect? Would the chromatin here be the same tightness or looseness as here? And the assumption is no. Now, would one of these be heterochromatic? And the answer is no. Both of these would be euchromatic, but one would be looser than the other. So it's not, we talked about relatively tight and relatively loose, but both of these are loose and looser in a eukaryotic cell. So which one is looser? It's going to be the chromatin with the transferrin gene in the liver cells, and it's going to be the region with the globin gene in the red blood cell precursors. Now, we spent a lot of time last time talking about transacting factors and cisacting sequences and so forth. What's responsible for the difference here? So let's put it in. There must be control elements or cis-acting sequences next to each of these genes, the promoter plus the control elements proximal and distal. So I'll just lump them together, and I'll put in the cis-acting sequences for the transferrin gene and the cis-acting sequences for the globin gene. Of course, transcription factors or transacting factors in both of these cells. They are proteins that sit on the various cis-acting regulatory sequences. So there's also transcription factors in the red blood cell precursor, and there are transcription factors, or we could call them transacting factors, in the liver cells. So I have a question for you. This is the question we posed at the end of class last time. If these two cells are different, what's different? Is it the cis-acting sequences or is it the trans-acting factors? Now, what I want you to do is think about this for a minute, discuss it with your neighbor, and then we will take a vote. What is the difference between these two cell types? Is it in the transcription, the trans-acting factors or the cis-acting regulatory sequences? differences in the cis-acting regulatory sequences. How many people are not sure because it's too early in the morning? How many people think it's the transacting factors? So the transacting factors have it, but there are a lot of undecided people here. So let's go back and think for a minute. Where are the cis-acting regulatory sequences? Notice they're in the DNA, right? What did we say about the DNA? We said the DNA was the same. So in fact, they have to be the same. Whatever sequences are in front of the transferrin gene in this cell are in front of the transferrin gene in this cell. They cannot be different. So what has to be different is the transacting factors. It has to be that some specific bunch of transacting factors, primarily transcription factors, are made in a liver cell. And so they sit, if we think of them as activators, there's an activator sitting here turning on the transferrin gene. But there's no activator protein sitting here turning on the globin gene, and vice versa. So it has to be the transacting factors. Now, of course, that leads to the question of who turns on the genes that make the transacting factors. And that is the question of development, and that is what Dr. Heitland will talk about. The answer is not completely known, but we know some of it. Now, I just want to say one more thing about the cis and the transacting factors. We said last time that you can get coordinate control because you can have gene X and gene Y, and they can have the same cis-acting sequence. So the same transacting factor, if the cell makes it, will sit here, it'll sit there, and it'll turn them both on. But we also said that most genes have more than one regulatory sequence or binding site for a transacting factor. So I'm going to add a third gene. And I'm going to make the assumption that there's not one, but two regulatory sites. And in order to turn the appropriate gene on, the right transacting factor has to be sitting on both of them. How many transacting factors does it take to turn on any combination of these three? You might think you need three different factors, but the fact is you don't. You only need two. And the reason is, suppose you have two transacting factors or transcription factors, A and B, and this one has two binding sites for A, this one has two binding sites for B, and this one has for each. Now, this means if you make transcription factor A alone, which genes will you turn on? Yes. Just this one. What if you make just transcription factor B? Then you'll turn on gene Y. What if you make, what, will you turn on either of these? To turn on this one, you have to have both transcription factors. But if you have, let's say, both, you'll turn on all three. Now, the real truth, so you have three conditions with only two transcription factors. You can turn on just this one, or all three of them. Yeah?
Is that supposed to be C or A?
Oh, which where? Here? Oh, excuse me. This should be A. Sorry. That should be A. So if the point of this argument is that if you have multiple regulatory cis sites in front of each gene and you have a combination of transcription factors, then you can turn on different combinations of genes in response to different signals. And that is what is thought to happen. Now, I just want to say one word. When we say the same transcription factor, A, binds here and here, we don't mean the same molecule. We mean the same type. And that if you have enough copies of factor A, some will bind here and some will bind there. Now, there's one more thing that I want to mention. In this particular case, where one cell is making one total globin and the other is making transferrin, which are two totally different proteins, it's very clear that you have transcribed two different genes, made two totally different messages, and made two totally different proteins. Is it possible to have two cell types that have the same gene transcribed, but you end up with different proteins. So you have one gene, and you transcribe it, but in one cell type you get one protein, in the other cell type you get a different protein. It turns out the answer is yes, but the proteins aren't going to be totally different. The proteins are going to be variants of the same thing. And the reason this happens is because of processing. It's not enough to make the transcript. It usually has introns, for example, and you have to take them out. And there's often more than one way to do it. Now, we're going to talk about an example of this in a little while, of a case where one cell type makes a protein that's part of the membrane, it's transmembrane, and another cell type makes a variant of the protein that's secreted. Now, the reason for that is different processing of the same transcript, two variants of the same protein. Now, before we start talking about how this works, I want to think about this question we had, the second question, which is not how do you make one protein versus another, but how do you make more or less protein? And to consider that, you have to think, what are the steps in going from the DNA to the protein, which we've started to do already. In bacteria, the situation is very straightforward. In prokaryotes, once you make the DNA, once you transcribe the DNA to make the RNA is automatically translated because transcription and translation take place in the same compartment. A prokaryote is a one-celled organism with no subcompartments. So as soon as you make the message, the ribosomes attach and you start making protein. So translation follows immediately upon transcription. There's a second, that's because it's just one compartment. The second thing to keep in mind is how long does this message last? In a prokaryote, virtually all messages have a short half-life. So they have a short half-life, and they're translated right away. It's automatic. Now, what's the situation in eukaryotes? We've already started to indicate that in eukaryotes, it's more complicated. Because once you make the transcript, it doesn't get translated right away. And one of the reasons for that is in a eukaryote, transcription takes place in one compartment, the nucleus, and translation takes place in another compartment, the cytoplasm. So this message doesn't get translated right away. It gets fiddled with first. It gets processed. And we will in a minute discuss the fine points of that. It turns out you have to add something proper to the 5' end, something proper to the 3' end, and you have to splice out the introns. So we'll come back to the details of that, but you have to process it until finally you have the right thing, a real message. But you still can't translate it. Why not? What do you have to do first? It's in the nucleus, right? So we got to move it to the cytoplasm next. So it has to go through one of those nuclear pores out into the cytoplasm. So you don't just regulate transcription. Regulating transcription is the major thing in both cell types. Transcription is the major control point in both of them. But in prokaryotes, it accounts for a much larger proportion of regulation. Regulation of later steps in prokaryotes is very small, although there are examples. But in eukaryotes, even though regulating transcription is a big deal, there are many other points at which you can regulate protein synthesis. You can affect the amount of protein you're going to get out of this. because it doesn't just depend on how much RNA you make. It also depends on how effective processing is and, in fact, which way you process it. Because remember, we said there's sometimes more than one way. So from the same transcript, you can get more or less message. But then you have to think about transport. The transport can be regulated too, so you could make the message and hold it up in the nucleus and you wouldn't get any protein. So you regulate transcription, you can regulate processing, you can regulate transport. So you get your message into the cytoplasm. In prokaryotes, there's relatively little regulation of translation per se. But that's not true in eukaryotes. So we want to continue our picture. Suppose the message now has arrived in the cytoplasm. In eukaryotes, often translation itself, per se, is regulated. Now, one of the reasons for that is there's a difference in this half-life business. In prokaryotes, message just automatically doesn't last very long. But in eukaryotes, it's enormously variable. Some messages just last a very short time and you make a burst of protein. Some messages last for days, weeks, or very long time. So the half-life is very variable. Some messages get degraded right away, some stay around and are resistant. So one way you can regulate the amount of protein you get out of this message is by how long the message lasts. But there's another way of regulating how much protein you get out of the message, and that has to do with how often this message or how efficiently this message is read by ribosomes. Even if it's there, if the ribosomes don't attach, you don't get any protein. So just as with transcription, it is getting started that is the big deal. Once you get transcription started, then you go to the end of the section. Once you get translation started, you usually go to the stop codon. But starting and stopping is a big deal. So the other thing you can control is what's called initiation, meaning the starting of protein synthesis, the attachment of ribosomes, the binding of the first transfer RNA, and getting the operation started. So if degradation increases of message, what will happen to protein synthesis? It will decrease. But what if initiation increases? Then protein synthesis will increase because the ribosomes will attach more often and you'll get more protein per message. So there are many points of regulation, all of which are we know examples of. That is, we know cases of regulation at every step in this process. And we will meet some examples as we go. Now, it's worth pointing out that once you get the protein, you can control how well it works, how long it lasts, etc. But here, we are only talking about production of protein. We're not considering what happens to the protein after you've made it. We'll talk about that a little bit at the end if we have time. But we're considering how can you control which proteins are made and the amount of them. So before we get into the details of processing, which is what I want to talk about next, let me ask if there are any questions. Yeah?
Does the size of the message matter?
Does the size of the message matter to what?
In terms of how you know whether you get more or less protein. It's a small message, or if it's a really, really long message.
Whether it's a small message or a long message affects the length of the protein that you make, and it may affect how many molecules of protein you can churn out per minute because it just takes longer to go down the message. But other than that, I don't think so.
Can you reiterate the state of the chromatin?
Say that again?
Can you reiterate the state of the chromatin?
You mean back up here?
Yeah.
Well, the only question was what's tighter and what's looser.
Right.
So what do you think?
The globin.
Here. In this example, which one is looser?
Transferrin.
Transferrin, right.
And yet, and the other one is...
It's the other one, it's reversed. That's exactly right. So now, yeah.
What are the things that change the rate of initiation and rate of degradation?
What changes these things? We're going to do some examples in a bit. Okay, so the biggest, the two things we want to look at more closely is how you have regulation or changes in processing and some examples of how you have regulation at translation. Now, we've already talked a lot about how translation works, but we haven't really talked about processing very much. So I want to go over the basic steps of normal processing, and then we'll see how you can vary that. So for that, you need handout 11A. So what we've got here at the top is a stretch of DNA. And as we said last time when we were talking about the features of genes, you signify the start of transcription by a bent arrow. So this is where transcription starts. And to make this the simplest possible gene with introns, it's going to have one exon, two exons, and one intron. First, we're going to consider how you make the transcript and then how you get rid of the intron. Now, you notice over here to the left, there's more DNA. Is this an intron or an exon? The answer is it's neither. This is a spacer in between this section and the next transcribed section. It's neither. An intron has to be between exons. So this is the end of the exon. And so there's a spacer on the right and a spacer on the left. So the first thing that happens is you start transcription. So you have to open up some of the DNA. And you would start making a new chain. So this would be its 5' end. And notice that this is what people call a nascent chain, meaning it isn't finished. It's still only partially made. Now, the DNA, respectively, what would have been the template for this RNA? There would have been the strand with its 3' end here would have been the template strand or the transcribed strand, and the strand with the 5' end here would be the sense strand. So the message that we're going to get, or the transcript we're going to get, is going to be the same, of course, as the sense strand. Now, remember we said that you have to put something on the 5' end and something on the 3' end. The something on the 5' end is a modified G. And that goes on at this point. You don't peel the transcript off and then add the cap. The structure is called a cap, and it's added as soon as the 5' end is loose and available. So that's why in the next picture, it looks exactly the same, except it has a cap on it. The RNA has a cap. Now, the cap is a modified G, and it's put on backwards. So that if you think of what nucleotides usually look like, polynucleotide chains have one linked to another, let's say. So this is the sugar, the phosphates in here. These are sugar phosphate linkages. The very end of the chain originally looks like this. This is the first nucleotide, and then we added the next one, then we added the next one. Now, when we say you put on a modified G backwards, we mean it's this way. You line it up like this. And there's a special enzyme that does that, and it actually removes It gets rid of this and makes a bond. Now, you don't need to know the details of this, but the point is, this is why they call it a cap, because we basically put a little blocker on the end. And this G is modified, and if you're interested in the exact details, you can look it up in your textbooks. But you end up then with a little blocking group on the 5' end. Now, what is this for? The real answer is we don't know. It's just there. But you can do experiments to see what happens if you get rid of it. The cap seems to help with ribosome attachment, and it may also prevent degradation. So this is sort of both a blocker and may also facilitate some of the function of message later. So now, once we've got the cap on, we can continue transcription. If the gene is relatively short, you probably finish transcription and then do the splicing. If the gene is very long and the transcript is very long, you probably start splicing before you finish the job. But we're going to draw it as two steps. We're going to do the transcript first and the splicing afterwards. So if you look at your next picture, so this was one, and then in two we added the cap. Now if you look at the result of three, all that's happened really is the transcript has gotten longer. But you notice we've now written some things on the transcript. In bacteria, there appears to be a sequence in the DNA which causes transcription to stop and RNA polymerase to fall off. In eukaryotes, at least most of the time, there doesn't seem to be that. For RNA polymerase 2, there is no specific stop signal. However, there is a point at which you will cut the end of the transcript and add a modification on the end. RNA polymerase apparently keeps going. But if there's only a little bit holding it, it falls off. So RNA polymerase sort of keeps going, and then we pry the transcript off, and that causes the RNA polymerase eventually to fall off. So at some point, we're going to cut this chain so we can add the 3' end modification to it. How do we know where to do that? There is a sequence here, which in the RNA version reads usually AA, UAA. Now, this is the signal or the sequence, which means a little further down, cut the RNA. You don't cut the RNA exactly where this is. You cut the RNA somewhere between 10 and 35 nucleotides downstream. So remember, downstream is this way. So if this sequence is in the RNA at this point, where are we going to cut the RNA off? Somewhere down here. So somewhere down here is going to be the actual end of the RNA. So you can see in step 4, and it has a little arrow where it says cleave here. So in step 4, we cut it off. So now we have the message. Now I didn't draw that in there, but that AAUAAA signal is here, and we've now cut off the end. Now, RNA polymerase may keep going for a little while, but then it eventually falls off, and any RNA it has made is degraded, and those nucleotides are used over. Now, this AAUAAA is usually called the poly-A adenylation signal, because what we're going to add to the end is a series of A's. And these are added in the usual way, by splitting out pyrophosphate, etc. But where is the template for them? There isn't any. So there was a template for this part that had a C, a G, and a C, but there's no template for the added A's. Because there's an enzyme that just knows A, 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 doesn't use anything else. And so you add a series of A's, and this is usually called a poly-A tail. And it can be quite long. It's usually 100 to 200 A's long. Most, but not all, messages contain poly-A. It may be one or two enzymes that do this, but it's done together. So the cutting and the adding of the A's is probably simultaneous. So the net result here of 4 and 5 is you end up now with a message that has a cap on its 5 prime end and a series of A's, a poly-A tail, on its 3 prime end. Now, what's the point of the poly-A tail? Again, it may have something to do with degradation, and it may help transport out of the nucleus. And one possibility is that there are proteins that are thought to bind both to the poly-A tail and to the 5' end. So that in the cytoplasm, it's possible that the message is circularized. And so the ribosomes that fall apart when they get to the stop codon are actually right near the start codon, because this is a circle. And they can easily reattach and go around again. If any of you have seen the movie from Harvard, you may have noticed that the message forms a circle, like a snake biting its tail. And the idea is that's probably what happens here. Now, this poly-A tail business has a practical use. Transfer RNAs and ribosomal RNAs don't have A's on the end. So by using oligonucleotides that are all U or all T, you can fish out messages. Because this will stick to U, or T. So you can use the fact that it has a poly-A tail as a way of separating messenger RNA from all other classes of RNA. And that's turned out to be practically valuable. Okay, so here we have our transcript. This is often called the primary transcript. Sometimes people write the primary transcript as the raw RNA, no poly-A, unmodified, no poly-A, no cap. But the truth is, such a thing doesn't really exist. Because as soon as the 5' end is flopping off, you add the cap, and the only way you get the RNA off the DNA is by adding the poly-A. But now, what about introns? We have transcribed the whole thing. We put the right ends on, but now we have to get rid of the intron. Now, we talked about splicing a bit last semester, but I want to review the critical parts here. The bottom of this handout is actually the same as one you had last semester, but the numbers are different. So how are we going to get rid of the intron? So in the next picture, we've just relabeled it to show you where the introns and the exons are. This is the common, but not only, symbol that the boxes indicate where the exons are, and this in the middle is an intron. But remember, this is really one continuous RNA strand. So to get rid of the intron, we have to fold up the RNA. And then we're going to have to cut the RNA out and join the two of the intron and join the two ends of the exon together. Now, all of these steps are catalyzed by the spliceosome, which is a ribonucleoprotein particle, something containing both RNA and protein. We're not going to go into the details of how it works, but it's described in all of your books. It's a very interesting business. And some of it was figured out here. And quite a very famous finding, as it says in your notes, was found by an XTA from this class, who was a graduate student. So in the next step, what we've done, we've now labeled the two exons separately, just to make it clear when we join them what came from where. We're going to fold up the RNA like this, because this makes it a little clearer that inside the cell held by the spliceosome, the two ends of the exon are really quite close together. And so it's not so surprising that you can cut off the intron and join the exon without making a big mess. Now, you may or may not remember that it's customary to call this end the 5' or the donor site, and this end the 3' or the acceptor site. Now, if you think for a minute, that means we're talking from the intron's point of view, not the exon. So this is the 5' end of the intron and the 3' end of the intron. But of course, exon-wise, this is the 3' end of the exon and the 5' end of the next exon. So splicing occurs in 3 steps. First, you have to fold it up like this. And then you have to cut here. That's what happens in step 8. And this loose end here is attached to a specific base in the middle, which is called the branch point. So that's why when you carry out step 8, what you end up with is this picture. So here is what used to be the 5' end of the intron. And this is called the branch point. And the whole thing, because of its shape, is called, the whole intron is called a lariat now. Now, what do we have to do to finish this off? We have to join the 2 ends of the exon and get rid of the rest of the intron. So the next step involves 2 things. We're going to cut off the intron and join the 2 ends of the exons. So that's what happens in step 9. And of course, we haven't put in the old poly A thing. And now the lariat has been completely cut off. So this is what used to be, this is the remains of the intron. And it's going to be degraded and the nucleosides are going to be reused. And now the message has lost its intron, and if there are more introns, we would repeat the process. And now this is ready to go to the cytoplasm and be used to make protein. Now, the very picture on the bottom is there just to remind you that this transcript now contains only exons. And people usually say the exons are the translated part. Is all of this translated? And the answer is no, because translation begins at the first AUG codon, leaving a section that is untranslated on the 5' end. And it ends wherever the first stop codon is, leaving an untranslated part on the 5' end. So it's probably correct to say that the exons make up the part of the RNA that is used in translation, but not all of it is translated. You have to get the introns out before you can translate it. I have to remind you that bacteria do not have introns and they don't have spliceosomes, so they don't have the enzymes you need to get rid of introns. Now, I think that's what I wanted to say about normal, simple processing. And now I want to go back to this question of regulating processing, but let's ask questions first. Yes?
If what is joining the 2 ends of the exon, because if two double-stranded DNA breaks, it's like, how do they not flip around?
Well, this is not double-stranded DNA. This is single-stranded RNA, remember. Okay? And what's actually happening here is that you're simultaneously, when you make this bond, that breaks this one. And when you make this bond, that breaks this one. Now, what's holding all of this together is the spliceosome. There are short RNAs in the spliceosome, which are aligned here to hold everything together. And then there's the protein part, which is enclosing it all. Yes?
So the cap comes on as the nascent chain is already being made, or is it the first thing that's put on?
Well, in order to add the cap, you have to... Her question is, when do you add the cap? In order to add a cap, you have to have a loose end dangling here. Okay, so you make the first maybe 10 or 50 or 100 nucleotides, and then you add the cap. Yes?
How does the RNA know where the introns are?
How does the RNA know where the introns are? This is a question which is not entirely settled. There are certain sequences in common found at the end of exons and the beginning of introns. But there are sequences like that found in places that are not spliced. So people are it has something to do with recognition by the components of the spliceosome. But exactly what the rules are that the cell follows, we're not entirely clear. But usually when you look at a sequence of a gene at the sense strand, you can figure out at least approximately where the introns end and the exons begin. But you can't always be completely sure. One of the ways you can tell is if you look within an intron, there are usually stop codons, and it clearly is garbage. It's not translatable. There was another question? Yeah.
You made it sound like the steps 4 and 5, the cleavage of the rest of your RNA and the addition of the poly A tail happen at the same time?
Do these happen at the same time? Probably they're tightly coupled. It may be different enzymes, but they happen right together. So as soon as you cut it off, you add an A. Yeah?
I'm so confused why you add a poly A tail.
Why you add a poly A tail? Well, the answer is you do. Okay, that's the way it is. Exactly why you need it is not clear. There are many explanations as to why you need a poly A tail, but remember there are a few messages that don't have one. So it's just not totally clear what it's for. But it happens to be a feature of almost all messages. Now, one possibility is that it's involved in getting it out of the nucleus. And another possibility is that this end can be adjusted in length, and that has to do with controlling degradation and the half-life of the message. Okay. Now, we have drawn a gene that has only one intron. But many, many genes have multiple introns. And a very large proportion of the genes in the human genome and that of other higher organisms are alternatively spliced. So let's consider the principle, and then we'll do a real example. Suppose you have a gene, and there's one like this written in your notes, that has, in fact, two introns. So this would be the gene or the transcription unit from here to here. Now, the obvious thing to do is to take out the first intron by connecting the first two exons, and to take out the second intron by connecting exons 2 and 3. But many, many transcripts are alternatively spliced, so that under other conditions or in other cell types, instead of connecting 1 to 2 and 2 to 3, that's exons, you connect the donor site here to the acceptor site over there. So you end up with a transcript that has exon 1 and 3, but no 2. Now, if you consider a gene that has many introns and many exons, which many of them do, the number of possible combinations is enormous. We know now that in higher organisms, many, many genes are alternatively spliced. And that explains a paradox that people have known for a while, that we don't have that much more DNA, say, than a fly or a worm. But by all accounts, we're more complicated. So the question is, how do we pull it off? And one of the answers is that from each of our genes, you can make multiple versions of the same protein, some of which work in some cell types, some of which work in other cell types. While the fly or the worm makes only one version of the protein and has to make do with the same version in all of its cells. And so we are able to do a lot of fine-tuning by making variants of the same protein. So this alternate splicing business turns out to be very, very important. And is perhaps the explanation for a lot of our abilities to do things. Now, I want to consider an example of this. It's the example I referred to before, and it involves really alternate processing not alternate splicing, as you will see. And it's on 11B. Now, I think what we're going to do is start with the bottom first, and then we'll work our way back. We know that in some cells of the immune system, there is a protein, antibodies are secreted. Remember, we always draw antibodies something like this. The cell has the antibody has a constant part, and then the variable part that binds to whatever its target antigen is. Now, some cells in the immune system actually secrete antibody. But other cells have the antibody on their surface. Now, you have many different antibodies, but we're talking about an antibody with the same binding part. Some cells have it on the surface, some cells secrete it. Now, how is this possible? Well, we know about how you take a protein and insert it into the ER, and from there it goes to the Golgi, to a vesicle, etc. So if you look at the case here on the left, here's the ER. Here's a cross-section of the ER. Here are the two membranes. Here is the lumen. We understand how a protein could get entirely into the lumen. If the protein has a signal peptide, then that allows it to enter the translocon. And then as the protein is made, it goes through the translocon into the lumen, and then you cut off the signal peptide, and the protein is in the lumen, and the protein folds up, and we'll draw our usually representation. So you can get an antibody inside the lumen of the ER. And then you form a vesicle that buds off of that, and that goes to the Golgi, and then a vesicle buds up from that. And then finally, you get a vesicle containing your antibody, and it fuses with the plasma membrane. And so when this section opens up, your antibody is going to be released. So we understand how that could work. Now, how can you get the same antibody, essentially, which is transmembrane? The difference is, really, all you need is a hydrophobic stop transfer sequence, a hydrophobic sequence right there. So the protein is essentially the same, has signal peptide, pretty much the same sequence, but near the back end of the protein, there is a hydrophobic section. So when the protein is moving through the membrane, when it gets to this point, it gets stuck. And the rest of the protein is made in the cytoplasm. So now signal peptidase comes along as before and cuts off the signal peptide. But what we're left with now, the protein doesn't get all the way into the lumen. It's in fact transmembrane. And to use the symbolism we've been using, it looks like this. Now what happens if you butt a vesicle off of here, then fuse that with the Golgi, butt a vesicle off that, and fuse that with the plasma membrane? So it's written out on your handout. But the final step is that your vesicle looks like this. Your vesicle looks like that. And when this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, what's going to happen is the protein is going to end up stuck in the plasma membrane. So what's the big difference here? The big difference is whether the back end of the peptide has a hydrophobic sequence or not. If it doesn't, the protein will be secreted. If it does, the protein will lodge in the membrane. So how can we make two variants of the same protein, same front end, some grabbers, but different back end? So that comes from alternate processing of the same RNA. So that's drawn on the top of your handout. If you look at the gene for this protein, it has 6 exons, and I haven't drawn 1 through 3 because they're handled the same all the time. So this is the 5' end of the transcript. This is the 3' end of the transcript. Now, remember we said that if you have a very long transcript, probably you start splicing it before you get to the poly A addition end business. And that's what's happening here. The way you can think about it is this is a competition between who gets there first, the spliceosome or the poly A adding enzyme. Because there are two possible places to add poly A and end transcription. One of them is here, and one of them is here. So possibility one, you start making the transcript. Possibility one is that the poly A addition machine gets there first, before you can do any splicing. So if the poly A addition machine is coming along, the signal to add poly A is here. So somewhere in here we're going to add poly A. So we're going to end up at the end of 4, we're going to add poly A. We're going to cut the transcript. Actually, here, we're going to cut the transcript, and we're going to add poly A. And if there's any more transcript that got made, it's going to get degraded and thrown away. Now, there are introns back here, and they would be spliced in the usual way. But there's nothing after exon 4, because we added poly A and stopped transcription. That's if the poly A addition happens first. But suppose the spliceosome gets there first. Then the spliceosome cuts out the signal for adding poly A, and the poly A enzyme can't do anything. And then the spliceosome cuts out this intron, and then the poly A enzyme adds here. So in that case, you get something. So this would have 4, 3, 2, 1. This would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then poly A. Now, the difference is that exons 5 and 6 code for a hydrophobic section. So when this message is translated, you get a peptide that has no hydrophobic stop in the membrane section. When this message is translated, you get the same front end, but now you get a hydrophobic back end. So this protein, when you make the corresponding protein here, it enters the ER, gets stuck in the membrane, and ends up on the cell. So what? Why do you need, for your immune system, both types of cells? Yeah?
You have different immune responses. Sometimes you want to respond to an antigen, and sometimes you want to kill it.
Which of these is going to allow you to know that you've met an antigen? This one acts as a receptor for antigen. Normally, if you're not exposed to antigen, you have cells with antigen on their surface, with antibody on their surface. So you have cells floating around that look like this. You don't have the other kind. Now antigen comes along. When the antigen comes along, it binds to this antibody. And that causes this cell to shift gears. It divides many times, and its progeny do the opposite. Its progeny now splice differently, and now its progeny cells release the same antibody, basically, which floats around in your blood and is ready to bind to and inactivate antigen. So the membrane bound acts as a receptor for antigen, and the released antibody acts as a mop-up system for getting rid of antigen, which you actually, when it's actually there. You actually have many cells like this with different antibodies on their surface. And when the right antigen comes along, it binds to the right cell and kicks in that type to make the right antibody. That's the basic idea. So this is one example of alternate processing. I call it that instead of alternate splicing because it's really a competition between poly A addition and splicing. Which way is it going to come out? Yeah?
Is this on the enzyme level of poly A?
It's not clear what it depends on. Her question is, does it depend on the level of poly A? I don't know in this case if people know exactly what triggers this switch. People are working on it, but I don't think they know. Yeah? Excuse me, just one second. Her question is, okay, so it works by alternate splicing. What causes the alternation in the splicing? And I don't know. Yeah?
So poly A enzymes also splice.
Poly A enzymes do not also splice. So what we're saying is you have two sets of enzymes. You have the spliceosome, which is actually an enzyme plus RNA, and you have the poly A addition machine, which cuts the message and adds, cuts the transcript and adds on the poly A's. Okay, so it's who gets there first. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Could it also be a possibly a survival mechanism? Meaning, let's say one pathway was blocked.
Well, it's possible that it's some kind of survival mechanism, but the question you're really getting at is, what is the value of doing this? What is the selective value which has led to this continuing? Is that what you mean? There are many cases where there are redundant pathways for doing things, and it's very valuable to have a backup. But I think in this one, it's not so much the backup value as the fact that you need both a detector system and an effector do-something system. And you have to have both. And the real question is, when you're exposed to an antigen, how do you know which antibody to make? And this tells you that, because the cells that already have the right antibody on their surface are kicked into action. But we'll talk more about that when we get to the immune system. Yeah?
Doesn't that make the constant part of the antibody no longer constant?
Doesn't that make the constant part of the antibody no longer constant? Yes. That's why you might notice when I was talking about the constant and I kept fudging it and talking about the same class and stuff like that. The truth is every constant region comes in two versions, the stick to the membrane type and the go through the membrane type. Okay. Any more questions? All right, so now what we're going to do is I want to consider the next step here. And I noticed that there's a typo in the notes, I think. I think it's called 3 when it ought to be 4 or something like that. I'll fix that later. So suppose that you transcribe the DNA, you make the transcript, you process it one way or the other, and you got yourself, and you send it to the cytoplasm, and you got yourself some RNA. So now the messenger RNA is in the cytoplasm. We come back to that question that we had here of how do you change the frequency of degradation of the message or initiation of the message? Now I want to talk about two famous examples of regulation at translation. The first one I want to talk about involves iron metabolism, and the second one is globin synthesis. That's one of the reasons for talking before about transferrin and globin. It turns out that in iron metabolism, there are several enzymes involved. One of them is transferrin, as we've discussed. And of course, transferrin has a receptor. We've talked about transferrin receptor. And there's also another protein we haven't mentioned yet called ferritin. Transferrin is in the blood. Transferrin receptor, though, is on the cell surface. So it can grab the transferrin and take it in by RME, harvest the iron, and send the transferrin out again, as we discussed before. Ferritin stores iron within cells, so that if you have extra iron floating around, it binds to ferritin, and that serves as a reserve for the day when your iron gets low. Now, it turns out there's a single protein in the cell that controls the production both of ferritin and of transferrin receptor. But it controls them in opposite directions. So you have two messages. One for one of those proteins, one for the other. I'll just call it A and B to keep it simple. 5', 3'. So in this case, you have a cis-acting site on the RNA, not on the DNA. And you have a transacting factor or a protein that binds to the RNA. It binds to the 5' end of one message and the 3' end of the other. So that means that the same sequence is found here in this message on the 3' end, and it's found here on the other message on the 5' end. So the same protein or transacting factor binds to both of them. And it acts in some ways like a repressor protein, except it's binding to RNA and not to DNA. Now, like a repressor protein, when it binds its small molecule, it changes shape and falls off. Then now it's more like induction. It's a repressor protein in an inducible system. And the inducer, so to speak, is iron. So the other state of affairs is like this. If you have high iron, the protein falls off, both of them. And if you have low iron, the protein without iron sticks to both of them. So what does this protein do? How does it regulate translation? Well, as you might guess, what happens if you block this end? That doesn't change initiation. It, in fact, affects degradation. So if you bind to this end, in fact, degradation is reduced because you block degradation. What if it binds to this end? If this acts like a repressor get in the way protein, what is it going to do? It's going to block initiation. So now, are you going to get more protein A or less? You're going to make less protein A, but you're going to make more protein B because you prevented degradation. Protein B lasts longer, and it gets read more often. And without iron, with iron, it's the reverse. Now, I have deliberately not told you which is the message for ferritin and which is the enzyme for transferrin receptor. And it's worth going home and figuring that out because that way you know if you understand the system, you can figure it out. And there is both a reference to Becker and to a diagram which shows exactly how it works. And this is an example of coordinate control because the same protein or transacting factor is governing the production of two different proteins involved in the metabolism of iron. And it's also an example of where the same protein can stick to two different places and have two different effects. Now, globin synthesis is also regulated at translation in a somewhat different way. It's also an example of coordinate control. What is globin? Globin is the protein part of hemoglobin. But in order to make hemoglobin, you have to have the cofactor, you have to have heme. Now, I have a t-shirt with heme. I knew I forgot something this morning. I forgot to wear my t-shirt with heme on it. Heme is a relatively small molecule. It's big compared to water or glucose, but it's very small compared to a protein. And heme is the cofactor or the prosthetic group of hemoglobin. Without heme, globin can't do anything. So when do you want to make globin? If you don't have any heme, there's no sense making globin. So when you have heme, that stimulates globin synthesis. And when there's no heme around, globin synthesis is blocked. Now, it turns out that the way this works is that globin synthesis is normally inhibited by something we won't go into, but it's written in the notes if you're curious. Heme blocks the inhibition. Heme inhibits the inhibitor. And one of the reasons for bringing this up, although it sounds extremely Baroque, is because this sort of situation is extremely common. That you do something and it inhibits the inhibitor. In other words, it releases the brake because you inhibit the inhibitor. Or as they say in algebra, minus times minus is a plus. And we will make many examples of this where something is blocked until it's unblocked. So heme takes off the brake, allows the synthesis of globin, and then the globin that's made combined with the heme to make active hemoglobin. So this is another example where you coordinate two halves. The production of the globin half is coordinated with the production of the heme half. Now, in both cases that we've talked about, translation is regulated by control by using proteins to bind to the messages. We mentioned last semester, and I should mention again, that translation can also be affected by the binding of short RNAs. And depending on the circumstances, these have slightly different names. They're called microRNAs or RNAi for RNA interference. What happens is if you have a message and you have a short RNA like 20, 30 bases long, which is complementary to it, so this is your short interfering RNA or RNAi, and this is your messenger RNA. So is RNAi like the sense strand or the template strand? It's like the template strand. It's an anti-sense. It's the complement of sense. When these two get it together, depending on the fine points, either you just block translation or you degrade the message. This was discovered by accident when people added double-stranded RNA to cells and discovered that cells had enzymes to take the double strand apart, cut it into little pieces, and use the antisense strand to turn things off. We now realize that's because cells have those enzymes for their own purposes. Cells use this and these enzymes to fight viruses, because many viruses have double-stranded RNA. Normal cells do not. Another RNA is also discovered that in some cells make their own little piece of antisense RNA. And they use that to turn off other RNAs. This appears to be extremely important during development in at least some organisms, that the cell uses not proteins, but short RNAs to regulate transcription, or may probably uses both. So the cell makes its own short RNA and uses that to regulate protein synthesis. Now, there's only one thing we want to say to wrap all this up, and that is that once you make a protein and you've got it, can you regulate further what it does? So by controlling whatever steps of transcription, processing, translation, or whatever, you have a certain amount of protein in the cell. Can you control what it does? Well, yes. We know that you can degrade that protein. Not just synthesis controls its amount, but degradation. Before we were talking about degrading messages. How do you degrade proteins? Usually by sending them to proteasomes. Notice proteasomes do not degrade messages. They only degrade proteins. So one way is to control degradation of protein, largely through proteasomes. So it's the balance of synthesis and degradation that matters, not just synthesis. But the other ways of doing it are by modifying the protein, either reversibly or irreversibly. Now, we know that things like binding to iron can cause changes in the protein, whether it sticks to the messenger or it doesn't. There are also permanent changes. So that's a non-covalent modification, and that's reversible. Are there any covalent modifications that are reversible? Remember phosphorylation? That's the most famous. So they're also covalent reversible. Adding iron or adding phosphate often changes the 3D shape of the protein and thereby changes how well it works, what it sticks to, etc. But if you have the right enzymes, you can put the phosphate on, you can take the phosphate off. That's the kinases, phosphatases, etc. And there is one more possibility, and that is a non-reversible modification. Have you ever heard of a protein after it's made being modified in some way that can't be changed but is necessary to make it work right? Remember glycosylation? There are others, but that's the most famous one. Adding some sugars to the protein is necessary to make it work properly, like the M6P that delivers hydrolases to lysosomes. You can also make modifications which make a protein work worse, but I don't know of any example of that offhand. Oh, there's one more way you can change how a protein works, and that's where it is. Remember GLUT4. GLUT4 only works, it's the carrier for glucose, which is responsible to insulin, and it only works well if it's embedded in the appropriate plasma membrane. So in addition to these, you can also move something. So what we're going to start with next time is we're going to consider issues of signaling, which is how do you use all these mechanisms to take a signal from the outside and get a cell to do something interesting.